Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a podcast about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical freedom. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. When I was a scholar at the Cato Institute, interns frequently asked me for reading recommendations. My advice was typically to read books outside of the libertarian canon. This was for a couple of reasons. First, because understanding the ideas of those who disagree with us helps us be better advocates for our own ideas. But second, because thinkers who aren't necessarily aligned with our politics perfectly, or who reject them entirely, nonetheless have valuable insights to offer. Intellectual provincialism leads nowhere. It is with that lesson in mind that I brought my friend Jason Kuznicki on today to talk about the French philosopher and historian Michel Foucault. Foucault is often either looked at skeptically by non-leftists or just ignored entirely. But his studies of knowledge and power and the relationship between the two offer powerful tools for critiquing the state as well as other forms of coercion. With Jason's help, we explore Foucault's core ideas and some of his most famous works, and we place them in the context of the broader struggle for liberty. Be sure to stick around to the end of today's episode to hear a preview of our next show and to learn how you can listen to it 2 weeks early, as well as gain access to our fun Discord community and book club by becoming a Reimagining Liberty supporter. Foucault can be a little difficult to pin down from the perspective of academic disciplines. He sometimes gets referred to as a philosopher. His books, I think Barnes & Noble puts them in the philosophy section. But he also seems to be an historian, a social scientist. How should we think of him? Where does he fit into broader academic categories?
When he was given a chance to define his own project, he called himself a historian of systems of thought. This was in 1970, so kind of middle to late part of his career. And he had taken a chair at the Collège de France, which is an institution that offers a very large amount of academic freedom. And this is what he described himself as doing. He's studying the history of systems of thought. And I've always found that helpful as sort of a way to classify him. I don't think he's a social scientist. He's not careful enough in his research, to be honest. He's more of a philosopher, but what he's trying to do is to tell stories about how people thought in the past and how thinking changed over time.
Let me ask real quick then what you just said about not being careful, because one of the criticisms that I have heard of Foucault, and this might color the rest of our conversation, is that the veracity of some of his historical analysis can leave a bit to be desired. Is it true that he gets things wrong from a historical perspective? And does he get them, if he does he get them wrong enough that it impacts the way that we should think about, approach, or I guess use the conclusions that he draws from the historical analysis?
Well, yeah, definitely. An example of one thing that I would point to that he got wrong from my perspective is that he's famous for saying that until the late 19th century, the homosexual did not exist. And I can point to 18th century texts where we have descriptions in the police archives of Paris where the police are talking about arresting men who meet one another for sex in public parks. And they have their own codes by which they recognize one another, and they have this very clear sense that they all belong to a kind of persecuted minority, and they know about it, and the police know about it, and they're not using the word homosexual, but everybody knows what's going on, and everybody knows that there's this sort of settled disposition toward that. And so I don't really think he's being very careful about doing a historical survey. But at the same time, there's something very interesting here, which is that the profession of medicine and the upstart profession of psychiatry is, you know, they're both trying to figure out what's going on with these people, and they become an object of study in a way that they hadn't before. So he has the sort of philosopher's habit of trying to make these really oracular pronouncements, but then they kind of have to be qualified. Reading Foucault is a lot like reading Nietzsche, who was actually a tremendous influence on Foucault in terms of his own, you know, intellectual formation. Nietzsche was hugely, hugely important to him. And stylistically, there's a lot in common, especially in his earlier works, I would say.
We can also try to categorize him ideologically, which gets done a lot. We've had Jordan Peterson, I think, has lumped him in with the postmodern neo-Marxists, which is an awfully confused category if you know anything about Marxism or postmodernism. But how should we think about him? Is he a Marxist, as he's sometimes called? Is he a postmodernist? As he's usually, like, when you take a lit theory course, he gets discussed in that range of thinkers often.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that Foucault is a Marxist. I don't think the category fits very well at all. To a Marxist, all of history is the story of class struggle and the story of the implications of class struggle. So when you look at the 19th century, what you see if you're a Marxist is a story of the proletariat in conflict with the bourgeoisie. And Foucault is willing to admit that socioeconomic classes exist, and I think every good social theorist really ought to be aware that socioeconomic classes are real. But that doesn't make him a Marxist. And it doesn't make him a Marxist because the classes are not engaged solely in struggle with one another. They are one element of many in a complex, multi-causal story. And by the same token, the end game is not the same. For a Marxist, eventually, the proletariat is going to win, and they will do away with class distinction and make a society without arbitrary domination or oppression by capitalism. And Foucault is, in a way, a bit more pessimistic than that. He doesn't believe that history has that kind of endpoint to it. History remains always one damn thing after another. And if you think that there's a way to get out of power, to escape the, you know, power relations that structure society, you're probably missing something, or you've probably actually bought into one or another ideology that is not going to deliver what it's promising. He's in a way both multi-causal about historical events, but also not teleological about the direction of history.
What about him as a postmodernist, in the sense he does seem to be quite skeptical of or examines broader narratives that we tell ourselves about a range of things and the way that those narratives play into power and knowledge? Does that categorize him as a postmodernist?
I think that's a bit of a better characterization. At one point, he disavowed being a structuralist, and that has gotten him called a post-structuralist, which, okay, fine. I don't know. I tend to see him, and I've often talked about him as a perverse functionalist. And what I mean by that is that in old school functionalism, when you observe a social regularity or an institution or an ethos, you try to explain it in terms of how that phenomenon relates to the sustenance and the replication of the society that it's situated in. And so Durkheim, for example, described suicide as a kind of almost a social immune system, where when someone commits suicide, it's an indication, it's a social signal to everyone else that something is wrong here, that something needs to be done, and that contributes to social stability in the long run. The problem with functionalism as an explanatory model is that it really can't account very well for historical change. Everything adds up to the same. And where, that's classical functionalism, vanilla functionalism, if you will. The perverse functionalism that I would use to describe Foucault is that a phenomenon, an ethos, an institution doesn't actually point at or sustain society. It's self-perpetuating. We find institutions looking after their own interests. We find an arm of the bureaucracy that doesn't look out for the good order of society. It looks out for itself. It tries to maximize its power. And in that way, the theory is flexible and it applies to potentially a lot of different different phenomena in society. And it looks at them less systematically and therefore with a lot more nuance or particularity. And it's very skeptical of the kinds of overarching theories that a Marxist or a functionalist would bring to analysis of the same phenomenon. And that is actually a characteristically postmodern move.
So let's then dig into, now that we've categorized him or talked about why I guess he's can be difficult to pin down, let's talk about his ideas. So his main focus throughout much of his scholarship seems to be this relationship between power and knowledge and the way that they can define each other or play into each other. That's a big field. So maybe we always recommend like start by kind of defining terms. In this context, what does Foucault mean by knowledge? And I ask this in part because if we place it with the postmodernists, one of the objections to postmodernism that you hear from non-postmodernists, whether those are libertarians, conservatives, people on the right, or even Marxists, is that it's this rejection of the very possibility of knowledge, or turning all of knowledge, all of truth, into a social construct that is unmoored from objectivity and the ability to actually know things or to understand things or to just point at facts. Is that an accurate assessment of what he means by knowledge or how he approaches understanding it?
I think that for Foucault, knowledge is always useful to some end. And so a claim of a fact is not ever neutral. It doesn't ever have a politically neutral valence. And so if I were to start an essay by talking about a crime and talking about its perpetrator and saying, and by the way, he was a Jew, that would be perhaps a completely true fact, but it would have a political dimension. And the fact that I saw fit to point it out and to emphasize and talk about the implications of that fact, that is a political move. That situates me as someone who views Jews as suspicious and as potentially criminal, and I'm identifying this to bring to your attention. Now, you can say that that's a neutral fact, but in some ways, it's definitely not, and it fails to be neutral in the ways that I'm using it, the ways that I am using it rhetorically to call attention to a group that I want to exercise power over.
That's an interesting point because it seems obviously true, but it's one that gets sometimes rhetorically overlooked or rhetorically hidden in the, so it shows up in one hand in the I'm just asking questions approach to, trying to hide your ideology. But it also, a lot of people look at there's media bias, and the media is biased in a leftward direction is a common refrain. And for a lot of Americans, what they think that means is that the media basically lies in favor of leftist political causes, or it makes things up. You can't trust them. When in fact, the media bias has a lot more to do with when a reporter is reporting out a story, what facts, they're not lying, or they're not consciously lying or misstating the truth, but they are choosing which facts are salient to the story, and And the facts that are often chosen can have a political slant in sometimes a more, you know, certainly not in a rightward direction for a lot of the mainstream, you know, major news outlets and so on. And that seems to be another version of this, of, you know, so that the you're talking about the criminal and you mention in passing that they're a Jew, you're basically saying, I think that this fact is salient to the broader story I'm telling, in which in this case about criminality, or if you're reporting out a story for the New York Times or the Washington Post, I think that these particular facts are salient and that that can have that political charge.
Yes, yes. And it's something that's actually a lot bigger than that. You know, it's easy to grasp when we're talking about one line in an article written by someone who's putting it in there because they're anti-Semitic. But also that type of framing of a social phenomenon can extend to many people at once. So a researcher who is trying to figure out why people are gay, you might say, well, it's a neutral question. It's completely neutral. It's we're just trying to find the objective fact about the matter. Personally, as someone who actually is gay, it might be interesting to know why I turned out that way, but it is hard to deny that a lot of people who are researching that question or who claim to be researching that question are doing it because they want me to stop and because they want to have, again, a kind of power over me to impose a discipline on lots of people. And so the ability to select which facts are appropriate topics for study or which facts are not, those are in a sense political questions. They have an objective aspect to them, but I'd find it really weird if someone was researching race in order to make people look less like the race that they were born into and to de-acculturate them to their race. I mean, that's obviously something that we would find very threatening and troubling. And, you know, that's a made-up example, but real examples of that do exist.
I think one example of that is, I think what you've just described is basically the quintessence of the so-called intellectual dark web and its related heterodox, as they call themselves, thinkers, is they often like, I'm just looking into these issues, but the issues that they choose to look into almost invariably end up having this like culturally reactionary or right-wing slant about gayness or the real role of women or the necessity and reification of hierarchy or race and IQ, which a number of them are into. Like they can be doing their research, but the research topics that they pick, I think, are very much speak to this. And that's why I think that, you know, the intellectual dark web is ultimately like a pretty kind of right-wing movement, even though they might deny it, it's about topic selection and which pieces of knowledge they choose to emphasize.
Yeah, yeah. It's like someone who subversively points out, guess what? Did you know that people can't actually fully transition from male to female or from female to male? They still have an awful lot of the attributes of their gender assigned at birth. Well, yeah, of course I know that. Everybody knows that. This isn't actually a fact that anyone is ignorant of. It is a fact that you bring up purely for the political reasons. And I can easily imagine a counterfactual universe in which we had mastery over that technologies, mastery over the technologies needed to undo that fact. And then where would that be? You know, This is a question of our technological capacity. It's not a question that ought to touch on individual dignity or respect. It ought to be something that is completely ethically set aside.
Okay, I think this is a valuable way of thinking about knowledge, and a powerful and important one in the sense that it's not Foucault. And I mean, most postmodernists are not denying that there is such thing as true facts or that there is knowledge, but merely pointing out, or that, you know, science is just a social construct and there is no scientific truth and so on, but rather that how these things get used, how they get raised, where they're emphasized, where they're employed, has a political and a power relationship element to it that is almost inevitable, hard to escape.
Yeah, I wouldn't deny that there is such a thing as truth. What I would say is that what we take to be true today is always the subject of future conversations. And what's admissible or not admissible in those conversations and why is something that politics can and does contest. And that doesn't mean that truth can be whatever you feel like it. It doesn't mean that your gender can be attack helicopter. It means that we are subject to future developments in history. Nobody has escaped the ongoing push and pull of power simply because they believe certain things. I would say in a lot of ways, my thinking is postmodern, but I still got vaccinated. And I don't see a contradiction there. I think that was the best thing that we knew how to do for the problem at hand. And if I'd been a forward-thinking scientific person in the 18th century, maybe I wouldn't have gotten vaccinated against the pandemic. I would have hopefully had the resources to go to Switzerland or something and get out of the city. It would not have been the same treatment, and it would have been colored by the scientific beliefs of the time, which were by our standards wrong, and they don't seem to have been justified over time. But I would have done it.
Okay, so that's knowledge. What is meant then by power in Foucault's sense? Are we talking just political power? Are we talking hierarchy, social power? What's the scope of this?
Well, one way I've seen it is that the phrase knowledge is power should be kept in mind, and then also the phrase might makes right. And the power of knowledge is power and the might of might makes right are in some ways kind of the same thing. That's sort of one memorable way to put it. But naturally, when you're looking at this, you want to find some kind of a key or some kind of a system to it. Like, is it really the bourgeoisie oppressing the proletariat? And Foucault's answer to that in The History of Sexuality is actually no. It's not the bourgeoisie oppressing the proletariat, which is what Marxist historians of sexuality had said before him. Foucault marshals considerable evidence to show that new sexual discipline in the 19th century was something that the bourgeoisie was doing to itself. And it doesn't make sense in terms of trying to create a class of stable, docile, oppressed workers from whom we can extract as much value as possible. This is a thing that we expect of our sons and daughters. That they will exercise sexual discipline and avoid things like masturbation, which was taken to be this absolutely shocking moral failure and also conducive to terrible health outcomes, which is very odd, and its sheer oddness ought to be taken as evidence that it really doesn't have a whole lot to do with economic class struggle in the first place.
Let's turn now to, I guess, a couple examples of his works and walk through them to see how this kind of analysis plays out. So the first, his two most famous works are Madison Civilization and Discipline and Punish. So I'll start with the first of those, Madison Civilization, where he's looking at the way that the concept of madness originated, evolved, and was used within power structures and for social control and so on. What does Foucault mean by madness? And is it the same thing as what we today would describe as mental illness?
It's like there's a family resemblance between those two things, and they're not exactly the same. Madness was to him a concept that united moral elements and mental elements and also physical elements in ways that we don't see as necessarily having the same relations nowadays. When we talk about mental illness today, we often use that as a way of downplaying the moral dimension of an action or a person. So we might say, someone might say, this person who was it was a school shooter, shot up a school, he was mentally ill. And someone might answer, no, he wasn't mentally ill, he was evil. And that's a distinction that in the early modern era is frequently just blurred over or indistinct or not even present. And the same is true with the physical aspects of what we call mental illness, that someone who has an organic brain disease will behave in ways that we find difficult to account for otherwise. But to a person in the early modern era, there might be a much greater willingness to say, well, they're also evil, or they are also deluded in a way that can be talked about independently from the organic illness. What passed for a model of organic illness at the time was exceptionally crude and clumsy anyway. They have hysteria. Well, what's that? It's the uterus wandering around in the body. I mean, it's nonsense like that is their concept of organic disease in a lot of cases. So there is this sort of mishmash of ideas, or what Foucault calls a discourse, that unites organic disease, morality, and ideation all together in one package, and it's called madness. And nowadays we distinguish differently, and one of the markers of that is that we have a specific set of professions that is tasked with managing mental illness in a way that the early modern era lacked. And it's exactly that development of the professional specialization with its specialized body of knowledge that licenses intervening into people's lives, whether for good or for ill.
You had, prior to our conversation, you sent me basically notes towards an essay you're writing about Foucault. And in there, you talk about, within the context of madness and civilization, what was called the Great Confinement. Can you tell us what that is and its relevance to this discussion?
Yeah. So in 1656, there was a sort of general reformation of the hôpital system in Paris. The hôpital were not hospitals as we know them nowadays. They weren't specifically tasked with curing injuries and diseases, and fixing injuries and diseases. There's nothing like that. It was a place of confinement for people who were poor, for people who were sick, for people who were mad. And there was not necessarily a whole lot of distinction drawn among them. And once the Hôpital Général got going, it very quickly confined something like 6,000 people, which at the time was about 1% of the population of Paris, which is an extraordinary number. For reference, the United States, which is the most incarcerating of the industrialized nations in the world, industrialized democratic nations of the world, we incarcerate about 2.8% of our population. In the 17th and 18th centuries, this was something that was being actively done in the major cities of France in a way that hadn't been done before, this confinement of so many people. And what what Foucault does in pointing this out is to point out that the institutions that would later become prisons and hospitals and madhouses all have a common origin. They all started with this undifferentiated confinement of lots of different types of people by our lights. But at the time, it was, it's just the general hospital. That's where you go if you are unable to work or if you are poor or whatever. And why would a society do that? Why would they? that's sort of the question that he explores in Madness and Civilization.
And what's his answer?
That in part, the effort is being made to differentiate the people on the outside from the people on the inside. That if you're not confined, you can point to the confined people and say, I'm not like them. And there are even sort of social practices that build up around these places, like, hey, let's go visit the crazy people and watch them and see them. It's a kind of entertainment, but it's also a kind of reminder to yourself that you are occupying a different social place from them, and thank goodness.
Is this similar, or are there parallels to kind of a Carl Schmitt approach to distinctions between a people and nations, and that we define ourselves in opposition to?
Like the friend-enemy distinction? Yeah, it sort of is. I mean, it is in some ways. There's a kind of early 20th century or existentialist concern with the other in Foucault's work, although he did not consider himself, and I don't think it's really right to consider him a part of existentialism, strictly speaking, either.
Let's turn to the second of these two probably most famous works, Discipline and Punish, which Foucault often opens his books with very striking, just imagery. And so how does this book open?
Yeah, it starts with the execution of Damien, who is, as far as historians have looked into it, he was somewhat of a religious fanatic, and he failed to assassinate the king. And the punishment that he got is the thing that really gets Foucault writing, because he was, you know, very elaborately dismembered and burned and mutilated, why would you do this? You know, we don't do executions that way in our society. The France of his time, likewise, did not, you know, do that. What was the point of it? And the point of it to Foucault was that it was demonstrating to people the power of the sovereign over an individual body. Now, demonstrating that threats to sovereignty would be returned many, many, many times over. I mean, Damien himself, actually, historians argue about whether he wanted to kill Louis XV or just get attention. And one can say maybe he was really just an attention seeker. He didn't end up doing a lot of injury to, you know, to Louis. He ended up only giving him a minor wound. And in return for that, he was very elaborately taken apart by the penal system. And the question then becomes, how does one move from that type of punishment to punishment in mid-20th century France, or punishment in 21st century America, which in important ways are very similar. Punishment is taking place outside of public view. It is done by imprisonment, which essentially takes away time from your life and replaces it with this confinement that you would never otherwise consent to. It Foucault makes this very interesting remark that I'm not exactly sure what to do with, but I find very evocative, that prison is appealing to the authorities because it's the same type of punishment for everyone, and the thing that it differs in is just the amount of time that you spend in the prison. And so you can set up a kind of hierarchy of how bad you consider a crime to be, and you can signal that hierarchy of badness, or the hierarchy of badness of the individual, through the amount of prison time that they're doing. Which I'd like to do more thinking about that, and possibly writing about it in the future. That it's appealing to a fully modern as opposed to an early modern sensibility, because it's got this quantifiable aspect to it, which punishment through mutilation didn't have so clearly or across such a wide field.
It does seem like there's I'm just spitballing here, but it does seem like one of the things that modern contemporary industrialized democracies do is attempt to obfuscate the exercise of their power and how much power they exercise over people, and the degree to which it can often be just as brutal as what we've seen in the past. I'm struck by, it's been a successful project, I think, in looking at, like, say, America. I am struck by, you read the Declaration of Independence, as we sometimes do, and it gets quoted from on the 4th of July, and how unbelievably tame the system, the long train of abuses that led the founding fathers to decide it was time to rebel and violently rebel, looks compared to what the government does to all of us on I think just the criminal justice system as it exists in America would have caused the founding fathers to say, okay, it's time for rebellion, let alone like the degree of taxation and the degree of regulation and intervention and social control and all of that. But it's been in kind of a technocratic way, systematized, made scientific, made part of institutions and articulated processes that depersonalize it. And it feels like so what's done at the beginning of Discipline and Punish, where this guy is, I'm trying to remember all the stuff that's done to him, but he's drawn and quartered.
Hanged, drawn and quartered. Yes.
Which takes quite a while, and they have to like go back to it because like the horses can't pull him apart and they have to hack at him for a while.
Yeah, they botched it. Yeah. They botched the execution in part because, this is interesting, they botched it because this was actually the first time that they'd done it in quite some time. This was a practice that was on the way out. And it was only because he had tried to assassinate the King of France. It was an extraordinary crime that my own graduate advisor noted that, look, this was a weird crime, and that's why it got a weird punishment, and it's sort of not necessarily the best place to start your book about punishment with. But to that I might counter, yes, it was a weird crime with a weird punishment. You don't get that many would-be assassins of the king to be punished. But people accepted it. People didn't say, hey, this is horrible, we shouldn't have this. People accepted that that's just what happens to regicides. And they were, while it was not numerically frequent, it was also not considered an outrage or a horrible abuse of power at the time. A few people maybe, but for the most part, no.
Right. Whereas if the federal government had taken, say, John Hinckley Jr. and done something similar, or if we had taken, if it was carried out in a similar way, it would shock and horrify us because it's not the clean and systematized and clinical way that we think about the exercise of power today.
Exactly. And let's not kid ourselves, though, that there are some very serious downsides to the modern way of doing this. In our present day criminal justice system, virtually nobody gets a trial by jury. And that was one of the things that, in fact, is complained about in the Declaration of Independence, that there are trial procedures that are being imposed that are not what we have typically known. They are not consistent with the rights of Englishmen, and we should not, therefore, continue our political union with England. And why does it happen nowadays? Well, it happens because it's out of sight and out of mind. When you see a legal procedure TV show, there's just about always a jury trial. Maybe that's because it's good drama, but maybe that's because it's a comforting story that we tell ourselves, when the reality of criminal justice in the United States almost never looks like a jury trial and almost always looks like a really hard bargain that is struck between the prosecutor and the defendant. And the defendant has to decide whether they're going to take an enormous amount of prison time or a relatively small amount of prison time.
Your phrase, out of sight, out of mind, is maybe a good pivot to what is the most famous, I think it's a whole chapter in Discipline and Punish on the Panopticon, which is not out of sight, out of mind, but more out of sight, very much in mind. So what is the Panopticon, and what's the lesson we draw from it?
So the classical Panopticon is a big round room, like an amphitheater perhaps, where the bowl of the amphitheater is all covered with a row of prison cells. And the prison cells all face toward the center. They have a window that looks out toward the center that cannot be closed, and it's pretty large, or maybe it's just bars in the front. And there is, at the center, an observation post. And the observation post is ringed with lights that aim at the prison cells. And the result of this layout is that the person at the observation post can observe everyone in the Panopticon at any time that they want without being observed themselves. The lights make it impossible for you as a prisoner to see whether you're being observed or not. So there are two very different positions in this setup. One, the observer can see everything while never being seen, and the other, the prisoner, doesn't really get to see much of anything, and they are, at least potentially, always being seen. And this was a setup that Jeremy Bentham actually enthusiastically recommended, that this is how prisons should be set up to him. And Foucault finds this a very evocative and very important sort of social technology, because it sets up in the mind of the prisoner the idea that they are always being watched, or that they are always subject to being watched. And once you've sort of gotten the idea that you're always being watched, you're going to modify your behavior a lot more carefully, and you're, at least in theory, going to become a lot more docile and a lot more tractable to whatever goals the imprisoning authority has for you.
This obviously has quite a lot of parallels to our modern internet-connected world, whether it's the Snowden revelations of warrantless wiretapping and the government just scooping up massive amounts of data about what we're doing, or on the flip side, it gets called surveillance capitalism, of, you know, everything that we do online is tracked in extraordinary ways. I installed a DuckDuckGo, the like private search engine, has an app for the phone that is a VPN that blocks trackers baked into the apps on your phone that basically are phoning home all the time data about that the app is gathering about you. And it tells you, it gives you a little report. You can run through it and you can see, and it's extraordinary how all of these free apps that you install on your phone, you know, random like this sports news app that gives me scores and updates is attempting hundreds and hundreds of times a day to send information about my device, including attempts to get like my location, when I'm using it, how much I'm using it, all of it. But in this case, they're selling to advertisers. But like we have kind of all to some extent just internalized the notion that when we are in online spaces or when we're using an electronic device, which now we're carrying around in our pockets with us, but you know, basically all the time, except when it's on the stand next to our beds, is telling various people we can't see everything we're up to.
Yeah. Yeah. The Jeremy Bentham style Panopticon is sort of like Panopticon 1.0, but there are so many different variations on it in the modern world that once you get this idea of looking for privileged places of surveillance, once you start to look for them, you start finding them everywhere, and they really are very, very common in online life. That's absolutely true, that most of us are under surveillance all the time. And we either modify our behavior or potentially subject ourselves to being disciplined if we fail to. And yeah, we should ask ourselves about that. That is an excellent example, and it's sort of become one of the iconic examples of Foucault's idea of power. Power in its absolute crudest sense might be, I have a gun and so I can kill you. But why stop there? There are so many more things that you can do with the threat of death, including putting someone into a panopticon. Why not do that instead? Then you can have many, many more outcomes from your power. You can do more things with it. The mere power to kill or refrain from killing somebody is small stuff compared to the way that social technologies can let you rearrange the lives of others.
What then do we make of, you know, so like let's go back to the Bentham style panopticon of the observation booth in the center of this amphitheater, and there's a guy in there who could be watching at any time any particular one of these things, and so he has a lot of them, and we can have a similar thing with, say, the NSA is scooping up extraordinary amounts of data, so is watching all of our electronic communications or a large portion of them at any given time. But it often, the result of that isn't so much domineering social control on the part of the observer. It can be, like in some countries, it absolutely is. In China, it can be.
In China, they
but
do, yeah.
Here, the problem that seems to arise is that it results in the gathering of basically an overwhelming amount of information for the observer to the extent that they can no longer really act upon it. It like swamps the meaningful information. And so we talk about these. There were, in the aftermath of 9/11, there were these fusion centers, which was, 9/11 was seen as a failure of the observers. Like, the observers didn't catch all of the obvious signs that they would have in order to prevent this, or they were caught, but they weren't coordinated in any way. And so the fusion centers were an attempt to say, we've got these different agencies gathering information. We need ways for them to be compelled to talk to each other instead of walling themselves off in bureaucratic infighting. But the fusion centers didn't accomplish much because it was like so much information that you couldn't make sense of it. And so does the panopticon, if it grows sufficiently large, does it ultimately become self-defeating?
Well, maybe it does, yes. This is an example of a potential site of resistance for Foucault. And resistance to him is also an aspect of power. The mere fact that you have to resist implies the existence of power to begin with. And power to him is not something that is either monocausal or omnipotent. It is not the case that just because someone occupies a position of power or some institution holds a large amount of power, that it therefore always gets its way. it is possible to resist, and it is possible for an individual or an institution with power to fail to use it. And so that seems like it may be an example of exactly that. The failure to integrate all of the different data bits into a coherent picture means that the power of the NSA only goes so far, and what it can do only goes so far. And that doesn't mean I'm blessing terrorism here. Very, very far from it. I would certainly prefer to live under the United States government as it currently exists, warts and all, rather than living under Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. But still, that is how they manage to do what they manage to do, is that they have exploited a kind of gap in the power structure.
I want to ask you about something that's also in this draft essay that you're working on. About you address libertarianism and classical liberalism directly here. So I'll read this passage. The most Foucauldian criticism that I can make of contemporary American libertarianism and classical liberalism is as follows. Libertarians rightly recoil at biopower and its soul-crushing ministrations, well and good. But it's often the case that they would rush headlong from technologically and psychologically sophisticated forms of power into older and coarser forms that aren't in any sense much better.
So what I mean by that is that to the extent that there is a narrative arc to history in Foucault's work, it looks something like this. In ancient societies, the government, such as it was concerned with allocating the power to kill. In the Roman Republic, the patriarch of a family had the power to kill anyone in their family if they wanted to. Usually that was exercised to expose children who were thought unfit to live or be part of the family. But if a patriarch killed a slave, okay, that was fine by Roman society, and few people would complain. The way that power developed from there, though, was increasingly toward extraction, toward getting tribute and then taxation, which is a more organized form of tribute, from getting tribute in kind to tribute in money. Power begins with the threat of death, but then it starts doing things like taking your money on pain of death. And the government that can kill you can take your money instead. And the government that can take your money can use that money for other purposes. Or it can say, I want you to obey the speed limit or else I will take your money. And so we move from very crude exercises of power that pretty much always leave somebody dead or injured to exercises of power that push those very crude threats or crude actions into the background and instead orchestrate the actions of a population or aim to orchestrate the actions of a population and perhaps even to order their thoughts and their allegiances in very detailed and sort of psychically demanding ways that the government ends up controlling not our lives but our thoughts. And where I am criticizing present day libertarianism is to say, look, we ought to consider that romanticizing the 18th century, for example, doesn't get us to freedom. It gets us to an older and cruder form of power. Romanticizing the Roman Republic, which you still do sometimes find in a lot of places, does not get us free of power. It gets us to an older and cruder form of power. And so what's needed is a recognition that power has taken many forms over time, and the ability of an individual to freely chart their course of life remains ephemeral, remains a difficult thing that, you know, people only rarely achieve, perhaps.
A couple of questions now that were raised in the Reimagining Liberty Discord, which, to be crudely commercial for a moment, for listeners out there, you can become a supporter. Just go to reimaginingliberty.com/subscribe, or there's a link in the show notes, and you'll gain access to our super fun Discord, where you can offer up questions for future episodes or join our book club or talk with a lot of really smart people. But here are a couple of them. So the first is about Foucault at the end of his life. Is it true that he took a more liberal, market-friendly turn and away from the more leftist politics, if not Marxism, that characterized much of his career? Is that true? And if so, what should we take from it?
It is to some degree true. I don't want to say, he was one of us, because he really wasn't. Near the end of his life, he did have some praise for the Austrian School of Economics. He did say that people who are thinking along those lines are examples of the will not to be governed, which, you know, in a system like this is obviously important. He also did have kind words for Maoism, and he did have, near the end of his life as well, a favorable view of the Iranian Revolution, which is shocking and inexplicable to me, and I absolutely don't want to defend either of those. We've forgiven about as much, I think, as a movement from the likes of Murray Rothbard, who was thrilled that the South Vietnamese state was falling. I wouldn't have found that thrilling if I'd been alive at the time. I think I would have found it very sad. I'm a lot less interested in the particular political conclusions that he came to, and a lot more interested in what I see as useful ideas for thinking about social relations and social theory.
The other is about a line from his book on the genealogy of ethics that speaks to, because a lot of what we have discussed today has been fairly grim, right? Like, this has been him talking about just how power gets exercised in awful ways, the way that we internalize it, and so on. And so how we should take kind of the outlook and character of his broader project. And so he writes, I'll read this short passage. "My point is not that everything is bad, but that everything is dangerous, which is not exactly the same as bad. If everything is dangerous, then we always have something to do. So my position leads not to apathy, but to hyper and pessimistic activism. I think that the main ethico-political choice we have to make every day is to determine which is the main danger." How should we interpret that?
I think that this is not a text, I should say, that I'm familiar with, but he said similar things elsewhere, and I don't find that unrepresentative of his thinking. And what I would say is that if you're looking for someone to ride in on a white horse and save you, forget it. That's not how history works. That's how maybe literary narratives work, but not history. And if you are expecting that there will come some time when we've escaped from history, you should forget that too. There's not going to be the kind of Marxist or Hegelian end of history after which oppression and power cease to be going phenomena. They will still be there, and you're going to be stuck with them. And so what you need to do is ask yourself, in the situation that you're in, and with careful reference to that situation, what are the mainsprings of power as it currently exists?
one of my projects with Reimagining Liberty is to introduce libertarians, radical liberals, classical liberals to thinkers and ideas that they can benefit from, that they can gain from, but are coming from places, whether that's individual thinkers or schools of thought, that they tend to either dismiss out of hand or ignore or believe aren't worth exploring. And for a lot of liberty-minded people, Foucault falls into that category. He's just this.
Oh yeah, you might get lefty cooties if you read his books or whatever. Yeah, I mean,
exactly.
To me, being an intellectual means you've got to read everything and read things that you're not supposed to read, especially. And maybe my take on Foucault is a bit against the grain, and probably if you were to resurrect a 1960s French Marxist, they would say, you've really got the guy totally wrong. But that's not the point. The point is not to sort every different thinker into this or that box, which you can then toss away. The point is, I would say to go around picking up different clever tricks from this or that author that you can then redeploy yourself. And I think that there is a very cogent, if you will, libertarian reading of Foucault that makes him very useful to someone who is concerned primarily with state power, who is primarily concerned with the way that states are seeking to control populations and to govern them, not merely in the sense of subjecting them to law, but to govern people in the sense of living rent-free in their heads, taking an active role in the moral and psychological direction of people, the likes of which used to be done by churches when people were much more religious, but now it would seem that governments are stepping into that place. And that again is a theme in Foucault's work that ought to be considered very carefully by us.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jason. Next time on Reimagining Liberty, I talk with Corey Massimino about anarchism. Here's a preview.
I think in many ways, anarchism is not at odds with rule of law, even though the terminology sounds like they don't go together. But anarchism, I think, is the culmination of rule of law. Rule of law is positioned against rule of men as the rule of power, as might makes right, as people lording power over others. So anarchism is the exact opposite of that. It's the culmination of rule of law, not in the sense of law as in the sense of states and governments and systemic violence and systemic expropriation and things that anarchists oppose, but law in the sense of a system that treats everyone as dignified equals that can cooperate on their own terms and of their own accord.
If you'd like to listen to that episode 2 weeks early, as well as get access to our listener community and join the Reimagining Liberty Book Club, consider becoming a show supporter. Look for the link in the show notes or head to reimaginingliberty.com/subscribe.